Good morning. You're listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. LAB Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network, your main source of accessible community news and information located in Lowell, Massachusetts. We read local news, editorials, feature stories, and more. Today, I will be reading from The Sun, and I will be reading solo because I don't have anyone to join me. LAB would like to thank the Nancy L. and Richard K. Donahue Charitable Foundation for their support. Okay, so starting off with the front page of The Sun, the name of this article says Safety Focus, City Bids Out School Security Contract. So, out of Lowell, the city has posted a request for proposal, commonly known as an RFP, for a vendor to service the building security system for Lowell Public Schools. Security in the district's buildings has been on the radar and agenda of the school committee since 2024, including committee member Dave Conway, who has filed several motions on the issue. It is so important that the Lowell School Department and the City of Lowell continue to work together to ensure our schools are the safest environment for all our children and staff, Conway said by text Thursday. The contract includes 33 cycles. The previous contract was January 1st, 2023 to December 31st, 2025. The new contract will run from January 1st, 2026 to December 31st of 2028. In April 2024, Conway asked for an outside audit for the purpose of conducting a total safety and security assessment of the Lowell Public School systems, as well as the reestablishment of a safety task force. The last security audit of the district system and protocols was completed in 2016 by Safe Havens International. In an October 8th memo to Superintendent of Schools Liam Skinner, Mayor Daniel Rourke, who serves as the chair of both the City Council and the School Committee, reinstated the Safety Subcommittee and appointed committee members Connie Martin, who will serve as a chair, and Eileen Del Rossi and Dominic Lay. The committee has not yet met. At the city level, a consortium of stakeholders met monthly to discuss safety issues. The forum includes district staff, the Lowell Police Department, the Lowell Fire Department, the Health Department, and others. In previous reporting, Assistant Superintendent of Operations James Hall called the group an extremely valuable forum that's collaborated to enhance the safety of the school district students and staff. Excuse me, both the school committee and the city council are responsible for school buildings. The school district uses the buildings, but almost all are owned by the city. The district is responsible for custodial services like cleaning, while the city is responsible for repairs. The contract does have a dollar amount attached to it, but according to the city's documents, any bids above $150,000 require Division of Capital Asset Management and Maintenance paperwork to be submitted with the bid. The contract calls for the vendor to provide 24-hour central station service of components and zones of systems, weekends and holidays included. Furnish the local public schools within 24 hours a complete report concerning any defects, accidents, thefts, break-ins, crimes, occurrences, or damage or incidents in which the security system is involved. Maintain all alarm systems and individual components thereof in full operating condition. Respond immediately to requests for repair or replacement of the alarm system. The district's alarm panels are monitored via landline access but are a mix of wireless and wired systems. There is no uniformity of security panels systems across the 30 buildings, which use a combination of systems such as Honeywell, First Alert, Simplex, Partner Premier, Fire Burglary Instruments, and Wayne Watchman, a proprietary system of the current vendor, Wayne Alarm. The winning bid will include all labor, materials, tools, and equipment, and services required for proper performance of the work as specified in the RFP. The contract does not allow the contractor to assign, transfer, or sublet the security system work unless specific permission to do so is granted in writing by the school business administrator. The sealed bids will be publicly opened on December 10th at 11 a.m. at City Hall in the Purchasing Department, Room 60, 375 Merrimack Street. Okay, out of air, women convicted of animal cruelty after police seize 162 animals. I need a sip of water for this one. A 78-year-old air woman has been convicted of 30 counts of animal cruelty after authorities seized 162 animals and discovered several dead animals on her Taft Street property last year. In Ayer District Court on November 25th, Ruth Maxent Schultz received 1.5 years in the House of Corrections on the top count, with the term suspended for 2 years, according to the Middlesex District Attorney's Office. This means she will remain on probation during that time and could be required to serve the full jail term if she violates the conditions. As part of the suspended sentence, she was ordered not to keep pets or engage in farming and to undergo mental health evaluation. On the remaining 29 counts, Maxent Schultz was sentenced to 2 years of probation to run concurrently with the top count. Maxent Schultz's attorney, Daniel Murphy, said in an email to The Sun that his client, who has been described as benevolent lifetime caretaker of animals, is appealing the conviction, arguing the evidence was insufficient and that her constitutional rights were violated. Prior to the publication of these charges, in multiple news outlets, Ruth had earned herself a stellar reputation in the community for good character and her nurturing of animals for 7 decades, Murphy said. The case began on February 20th, 2024, when prosecutors said Ayer police officers were called to conduct a well-being check at the Taft Street property. Officers arriving at the scene saw animals roaming outside, including 2 ponies along with several goats and ducks. According to prosecutors, police also discovered multiple dead animals both outside and inside the residence, among them 2 goats at the front door and several more in a room littered with trash, feces, and debris. While searching for Maxent Schultz inside the home, officers found 2 baby goats lying side by side, 1 dead and the other alive but in poor condition. They also heard a dog barking from a back room and saw a duck wandering through the house. Ayer's animal control officer was called to the scene. Upon arrival, she reported hearing the cries of a baby goat and noted there was no food or water set out for them. On February 23, 2024, the Ayer police obtained a search warrant for the Taft Street residence. Working with the Massachusetts Society for Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, ANGEL, officers reported conditions consistent with what had been seen 3 days earlier. Prosecutor said police found a dog crate filled with fowl that had no access to food or water. When Tufts veterinarians arrived, they determined the animals were at risk because of the property's conditions and their lack of nutrition. The veterinarians concluded the animals were in a state of neglect and needed to be removed from the property. At that time, an injured adult goat seen limping with a broken leg was treated by veterinarians and taken from the property. Ayer's health agent subsequently sought and obtained an administrative search warrant for the property. Inside a barn, the Neshoba Associated Board of Health and Town's Building Department reported finding a dead goat. Based on those observations, the Ayer police applied for and were granted a second search warrant for the barn and the remainder of the property. In addition to the livestock on site, police found dead and decomposing goats and chickens. Prosecutors said many of the seized animals showed signs of neglect, including emaciation and various medical issues. Several goats were suffering from abscesses and mastitis, while several fowl taken from the property were treated for lice. In total, prosecutors said 162 animals were removed during the 2 warrant executions, 49 goats, 91 chickens, 11 ducks, 8 geese, 2 ponies, and 1 dog. All were taken in the care of the MSPCA ANGEL. Murphy argues that the animal cruelty statute was misapplied and asked that all 30 animal cruelty convictions be reversed and vacated on appeal. In a sentencing memorandum he submitted to the court, Murphy said Maxent Schultz is currently appealing the convictions based upon insufficiency of evidence and several violations of her state and federal constitutional rights. He said that his client was not accused of maliciously harming animals, but instead prosecuted under a theory that she failed to provide proper food, shelter, or sanitary conditions as required by law. The memorandum added that the time of the police well-being check in February 2024, when the Air Police entered her property at 17 Taft Street uninvited for a purported wellness check, Maxine Schulte was operating her animal farm under a permit for keeping of animals and fowl issued by the town and had been subject to property inspections as part of the process by town officials, including the Air Police Animal Control Officer. Murphy said in his email to the Sun that the investigation was conducted by the Air Police, not the MSPCA Angel, which he said just assisted. And he criticized authorities for opting not to request necropsies, I don't know how to say that word, sorry, of the three deceased adult goats or the deceased newborn goats who simply failed to survive their birth in the bitter cold of February. A necropsy would have provided material evidence about these issues, Murphy said, additionally adding that it would, without it, prosecutors could not prove the animal died from neglect rather than natural causes. According to Murphy, at trial, Maxine Schulte took the stand during the five-day trial to testify that she had isolated one deceased goat in a stall to determine whether further examination was needed and had placed two others behind her home until the ground thawed for burial. She said she had contacted a man from a town cemetery department for help, but he was unable to assist. There was also evidence that the goats were in a near-frozen state, Murphy said. Maxine Schulte had testified, according to Murphy, that she had operated her goat herd for more than 20 years and customarily buried deceased animals in her enclosed garden, which was protected by electrical fencing. Murphy added there were insufficient evidence that any alleged unsanitary condition negatively impacted the health of the animals. Neither the statute nor case law defines that unsanitary for livestock and animals in general, Murphy said in his email. The defense attorney added that February 24th was kidding season on the farm when many goats were born, with some rejected by their mothers. According to Murphy, Maxine Schulte testified she tried to save them by bottle feeding every 4 hours inside her cluttered home. The rest of the animals, she said, resided in the barn and bird coops, while a dog and 10 young chickens were temporarily housed in the rear enclosed porch. In response to that, he said, were bored of health complaints about food storage. Murphy said that his client purchased a commercial shipping container for food and kept three large freezers of animal feed. Multiple bales of hay, enclosed in plastic, were regularly purchased and stored, with more hay kept in the barn. There was plenty of testimony of her providing regular food and water to her animals, Murphy said. The prosecution's primary theory was that of unsanitary conditions. To back up his claim about Maxine Schulte's stellar reputation in good character and care of animals, Murphy included seven letters from members of the community in the sentencing memorandum. One letter said, Maxine Schulte treated animals like her children. I never saw her abuse them, but always gave them the best care possible, the letter said. She's really a saint in this world. Murphy also included in the sentencing memorandum a profile about Maxine Schulte and her small farm published in The Sun in March of 2009. In that article, she was quoted as saying, now I'm balanced and in harmony, and geese are an important part of that harmony. The best way of working in the world is to do it in the way God created. Well, let's hope that all rectifies. All right, out of the Supreme Court, Texas allowed to use congressional map favorable to Republicans in 2026. Out of Washington, a divided Supreme Court on Thursday came to the rescue of Texas Republicans, allowing next year's elections to be held under the state's congressional redistricting plan favorable to the GOP and published by President Donald Trump, despite a lower court ruling that the map likely discriminates on the basis of race. With conservative justices in the majority, the court acted on an emergency request from Texas for quick action because qualifying in the new districts already has begun, with primary elections in March. The Supreme Court's order puts the 2-1 ruling blocking the map on hold at the least until after the High Court issues a final decision in the case. Justice Samuel Alito had previously temporarily blocked the order while the full court considered the Texas appeal. The justices cast doubt on the lower court, finding that race played a role in the new mapping. Saying in an unassigned statement that Texas lawmakers had avowedly partisan goals. In dissent, Justice Elena Kagan wrote for the three liberal justices that her colleagues should not have intervened at this point. Doing so, she wrote, ensures that many Texas citizens, for no good reason, will be placed in electoral districts because of their race. And that result, as the court has pronounced year in and year out, is a violation of the Constitution. The higher court's vote is a green light for their to be even more redistricting and a strong message to lower courts to butt out. Richard Hyson, an election law expert at the University of California at Los Angeles Law School, wrote on the election law blog. The justices have blocked past lower court rulings in congressional redistricting cases, most recently in Alabama and Louisiana, that came several months before elections. The Texas congressional map enacted last summer at Trump's urging was engineered to have Republicans give Republicans five additional House seats. The effort to preserve a slim Republican majority in the House in next year's elections touched off a nationwide redistricting battle. Texas was the first state to meet Trump's demands in what has become an expanding national battle over redistricting. Republicans drew the state's new map to give the GOP five additional seats, and Missouri and North Carolina followed the new maps, adding an additional Republican seat each. To counter those moves, California voters approved a ballot initiative to give Democrats an additional five seats there. The redrawn maps are facing court challenges in California and Missouri. A three-judge panel allowed the new California map to be used in the 2026 elections. The Trump administration is suing to block the new California maps, but has called for the Supreme Court to keep the redrawn Texas districts in place. The justices are separately considering a case from Louisiana that could further limit race-based districts under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. It's unclear how the current round of redistricting should be affected by the outcome in the Louisiana case. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton said the Supreme Court order defended Texas's fundamental right to draw a map that ensures we are represented by Republicans. He called the redistricting law the big, beautiful map. Texas is paving the way as we take our country back, district by district, state by state, Paxton said in a statement. This map reflects the political climate of our state and is a massive win for Texas and every conservative who is tired of watching the left try to upend the political system with bogus lawsuits. Texas Governor Greg Abbott issued a statement saying, "We won. Texas is official and legally more red." Democratic National Committee Chair Ken Martin said in a statement that the court's decision to allow Texas Republicans' rigged, racially gerrymandered maps to go into effect is wrong, both morally and legally. Once again, the Supreme Court gave Trump exactly what he wanted, a rigged map to help Republicans avoid accountability in the midterms for turning their backs on the American people. In the Texas case, U.S. District Judges Jeffrey Brown and David Guadarrama concluded that the redistricting plan likely dilutes the political power of Black and Latino voters in the violation of the Constitution. Trump appointed Brown in his first term, while President Barack Obama, a Democrat, appointed Guadarrama. To be sure, politics played a role in drawing the 2025 map, Brown wrote, but it was much more than just politics. Substantial evidence shows that Texas radically gerrymandered the 2025 map. The majority opinion provoked a vituperative dissent from Judge Jerry Smith, an appeals court judge on the panel. Smith accused Brown of pernicious judicial misbehavior for not giving Smith sufficient time before suing the major opinion. Smith, an appointee of President Ronald Reagan, a Republican, also disagreed strenuously with the substance of the opinion, saying it would be a candidate for the Nobel Prize for Fiction, if there was such an award. The main winners from Judge Brown's opinion are George Soros and Gavin Newsom, Smith wrote, referring to the liberal MAG donor and California Democratic governor. The obvious losers are the people of Texas and the rule of law. U.S. Attorney General Pam Bondi hailed Thursday's Supreme Court stay, posting on X, federal courts have no right to interfere with a state's decision to redraw legislative maps for partisan reasons. The new map eliminated five of the state's nine coalition districts, where no minority group has a majority, but together they outnumber non-Hispanic white voters. The total number of congressional districts in which minorities make up a majority of voting age citizens dropped from 16 to 14. Yet Republicans argued the map is better for minority voters. There's a new eighth Hispanic majority district and two black majority districts instead of none. But critics consider that the Hispanics or black majority in each district is so slim that white voters who tend to turn out in large percentages will control election results. Okay. Brian Walsh murder trial. Ann Walsh's lover takes the stand. On the fourth day of Brian Walsh's first-degree murder trial, Anna Walsh's lover spoke about the relationship and the tension in the Walsh marriage. Walsh was accused of killing his wife, Ann Walsh, in January of 2023. He pleaded guilty last month to lying to police and illegally disposing of her body, but claims he had nothing to do with her death. William Fastow on Thursday told the Norfolk Superior Court jury their affair began after Anna Walsh moved into D.C., a D.C. townhouse he sold her in the spring of 2022. The pair went to dinner and movies, sailed in Annapolis, Maryland, and worked out together. Fastow said he took her to his work functions and socialized with his friends, but they didn't socialize with hers. During the course of their relationship, Fastow said that Anna Walsh confided in him about Brian Walsh's legal trouble. Walsh had pleaded guilty to federal fraud charges, and his home confinement was predicted on being the primary caretaker for the couple's three boys. That meant the children had to live in Cohasset, which made Anna Walsh sad, Fastow said. Over time, he became despondent over the situation. He testified, it deeply upset her. Ann Walsh had told Fastow she was hoping that her husband would avoid prison time for federal fraud charges and that the family would then relocate to the D.C. townhouse. But in July of 2022, when Brian Walsh's sentencing was pushed back, the goal seemed farther from reach. It was then, Fastow said, that his relationship with Anna became more serious and he cut off seeing anyone else. The biggest stressor in Anna Walsh's life was not being able to resolve Brian's federal case, Fastow said. She felt it was holding up her life. By the fall, the two were spending holidays together. They went to Dublin, Ireland for Thanksgiving, a rendezvous in D.C. on December 24th, and subsequent snowfall made Anna Walsh miss Christmas Day with her husband and the kids in Cohasset. Fastow said that Anna Walsh told her absence upset her husband and that they had argued about it. Over the winter holiday, while Fastow was with his kids in Idaho and Anna Walsh was in Cohasset, they texted each other. Her last message came just after midnight on January 1st, 2023, wishing him a happy new year. The first few days of the year, Fastow continued to text and call Anna Walsh, but she didn't respond, he said. Worrying that she had blocked his number, he even tried calling her landline, but there was still no response. On January 4th, 2023, the day Anna was reported missing, Brian Walsh called Fastow. Fastow declined at first for fear Brian was calling to confront him about the affair. Sorry to bother you. Sure, everything is fine, Brian said in a voicemail after his second call, explaining that Anna Walsh was missing. Fastow immediately called back, then checked the garage at Anna's townhouse for her car using a code Brian gave him. But she wasn't there then, and still wasn't there when he checked back later in the day. Fastow and Anna Walsh were supposed to get dinner together that night. She had booked her flight to D.C., and Fastow had made a restaurant reservation. They were supposed to talk about their future together, he said, but they never got the chance. On cross-examination, Brian Walsh's defense attorney, Kelly Porges, pushed back on how detailed the couple's future plans were, getting Fastow to testify that they weren't concrete. Fastow said that Anna Walsh had wanted to figure out what would happen with Brian Walsh and his case. Fastow said he had his own concerns about how his oldest child would react to news that he was in a new relationship. During our conversations or time with Anna Walsh, she never told you Brian Walsh was suspicious of you, Porges said. Fastow mentioned that Brian Walsh once called him while he and Anna Walsh were out to dinner, which was unusual. The two men had only spoken on the phone a few times and never met in person. Fastow didn't answer. Brian Walsh allegedly later told his wife that one of the kids had taken his phone and made the call accidentally. That's the closest thing that happened where we were concerned about Brian had found out, Fastow testified. I'm not asking if you felt concerned. I mean, were you having an illicit affair? You're always kind of concerned someone's going to find out, right? I mean, I suppose, Fastow replied, adding that Anna Walsh had never told him that she was worried Brian Walsh knew about their relationship. In addition to testimony from Fastow, jurors also heard evidence that Brian's cell phone was tracked to a trash compactor where police later found brown, red stained clothing and rug samples, sewing tools, and a Tyvek suit. The police evidence also showed a Safari search for William Fastow from Brian's phone on January 4th, the day Anna was reported missing, and the two men ended up talking on the phone. Testimony on the cell phone data will continue to in court on Friday. Okay, what's next? All right, out of Lowell, the city of Lowell dedicated a stone bench to Centerville residents Bob and Ann Marie Page during a ceremony on November 7th at Mount Vernon Park, 169 3rd Street. The ceremony was attended by City Manager Tom Golden, State Rep Rodney Elliott, Centerville Neighborhood Action Group President George Procope, and the Pages and others. Out of Tewksbury, the town of Tewksbury released the availability of nomination papers for elected office in the upcoming 2026 annual town election. Nomination papers will be available at the town clerk's office beginning on Monday, January 5th. Town hall is located at 1009 Main Street. Offices open for election in 2026 are Patrick Holden, Select Board, Caitlin Anderson, School Committee, Jonathan Sampa, and Stephen Johnson, Planning Board, Jessica Rauso and Kathy Dwyer, Board of Library Trustees, Kristen Jeanzek, Board of Health, Mark DeFruscia, Housing Authority, Dustin Weir, Moderator. The annual town elections will be held Saturday, April 11th. The last day for candidates to file their nomination papers is Friday, February 20th, before 5 p.m. 50 valid registry Tewksbury voter signatures and addresses are required. For more information, call 978-640-4355. The Massachusetts Department of Transportation announces the fourth annual Name a Snowplow contest for elementary and middle school students in Massachusetts. The contest solicits names for 12 MassDOT snowplows that will be in service for the 25-26 winter season. Applications for snowplow naming contests are due by 5 p.m. Friday, December 12th, and winning elections will be announced by Friday, December 19th. There is no limit to the number of applications that can be submitted per school. The contest winners will be invited to participate in a scheduled snowplow unveiling event. A selection panel composed of MassDOT employees will choose two elementary school classroom winners that are located within each of the six highway division districts. The winning submissions will be evaluated based on two grade level categories, kindergarten through fourth and fifth through eighth. For more information, contact the DOT. Okay, Lowell, Mayor Daniel Rourke, Chris Dick of Pride Star Trinity EMS, and Greater Lowell Chamber of Commerce President CEO Danielle McFadden invite the public to Pints for a Purpose Sun Santa fundraiser Saturday, December 13th from noon to 4 p.m. at the Old Courthouse, 29 Central Street. Come grab a pint to raise $10,000 to help 100 families this holiday season. Music is courtesy of Paul Belly and Chris Brunel, with food and live auction at 2:30 p.m. All donations go towards the Sun Santa Fund. For more information, call 978-674-4040. And lastly, the Host Committee of Women for Howards holds a fundraiser to support State Representative Vanna Howard's bid to fill the first Middlesex Senate district seat on Thursday, December 18th from 5:30 to 7 p.m. at the Athenian Corner, 207 Market Street. Suggested donations start at $100. The state set a special primary election for the first Middlesex District special election for February 3rd, 2026, with the general election on March 3rd. The seat was formerly held by Ed Kennedy, who died at Lowell General Hospital on October 1st after an illness left less than a year into his latest term. Kennedy was first elected to the state Senate in 2018. Okay, WCAP Radiothon returns on Saturday. The annual event benefits the Salvation Army of Greater Lowell. The giving season is now in full swing, and it continues this weekend with the return of the annual WCAP Radiothon to benefit the Salvation Army of Greater Lowell on Saturday. On the heels of last year's $280,000 effort, longtime Radiothon host Warren Shaw told The Sun Tuesday the goal this year is to cross the $300,000 threshold. Shaw has been hosting the event on WCAP for more than 25 years, and will again this year, be joined by co-host Jerry Nutter for the radio broadcast from the WCAP studio on Market Street. Making the whole effort work alongside them, Shaw is a team of about 50 people who come together every year, who Shaw calls Team Radiothon. It has really become a huge event, said Shaw. In addition to the energy of the auction, the relevance of all of it that we have the Salvation Army doing their thing, Shaw said later. The money raised each year is significant, Shaw said, because none of it goes to things like salaries, but to the various local Salvation Army programs for community needs like housing and food assistance through its food pantry. That figure also represents the significant growth this event has undertaken since Shaw first started hosting it with Arthur Sutcliffe when they raised $5,000. The main feature of the Radiothon is the auction, which runs online concurrently with the radio broadcast. The dozen of auction items include a weekend at Omni Mount Washington Resort with lift tickets, tickets for Boston Bruins, gift cards to local businesses, signed sports memorabilia, and more. Bids can already be made online at SalvationArmyRadiothon.com, and bids can be made over the phone during the Radiothon broadcast from 6 a.m. to 2 p.m. Salvation Army Advisory Member Susan Plunkett said Thursday there were 108 items listed for bidding in the online auction, but she expected more items to be added before Saturday. The items like sports tickets and weekend getaways are the big ticket items, Plunkett said. But the bread and butter of the auction tends to be the many gift cards donated by local businesses. There's always ends up being a little bidding war on them because people feel that they're donating to something, but also getting something out of it, said Plunkett. The Radiothon is a long day for those who put it on, Plunkett said, but it always seems to be going by very quickly. I can't stress enough how much it is appreciated by the Salvation Army, the enthusiasm we get for the Radiothon, said Plunkett. The auction is only a part of the total fundraising effort represented by the Radiothon. A significant source of the donation total every year comes from Mike and Cindy Kunzler, the owners of Four Oaks Country Club in Dracut, who host the comedy night ahead of the Radiothon every year to raise money for it. Last year, the Kunzlers dropped off a check of nearly $111,000 from the comedy night during the radio broadcast. During the show, firefighters from fire departments of Lowell, Dracut, and Tingsboro, with Chelmsford joining for the first time this year, will also be collecting donations through their annual boot drive. Last year's efforts by the firefighters raised more than $30,000 for the Radiothon. It is just amazing how many people have come together to make this a success, said Shaw. Salvation Army of Greater Lowell Major Al Kruger told The Sun Wednesday the need his organization is seeing from the community has been steadily increasing on a monthly basis in 2025. With the recent government shutdowns and the impacts it had on federal food assistance funding, he said that need exploded. We were noticing an uptick as far back as January. The numbers would increase steadily month over month, and then once the shutdown hit, we saw astronomical lines at the pantry, said Kruger. for comparison, Kruger said they typically pick up between 4,000 and 5,000 pounds of food from the Merrimack Valley Food Bank every Tuesday. But when the effects of the shutdown were at their height, the Salvation Army was making weekly pickups of 6,000 to 8,000 pounds. The organization typically shuts down the food pantry in November and December as it shifts focus to holiday drives. But this year, Kruger said they didn't feel they should do that. Keeping the pantry open was once a week on Wednesdays for the rest of the year. We could not in good conscience postpone the food pantry until January this year, Kruger said. Though the Christmas assistance efforts by the Salvation Army through the Christmas assistance efforts of the Salvation Army last year, Kruger said 600 families and 1,600 children were helped. This year, that number is increasing to 620 families and 1,700 children. Kruger and his wife Amanda have been majors for the Salvation Army of Greater Lowell for a year and a half now. And with their second radiothon coming up, he said they've both been absolutely overwhelmed by the amount of community support they see in Lowell. People in Lowell are so gracious and wonderful contributors to the Salvation Army, said Kruger. We are just very blessed to be stationed here. Okay, out of Littleton, pedestrian seriously injured after being struck by a vehicle. A 79-year-old Acton woman was seriously injured on Wednesday evening after being struck by a vehicle while walking in a crosswalk near Littleton Common. The Littleton Police Department said the driver involved, a local food delivery driver, remained at the scene and has cooperated with authorities. Police and Littleton firefighters responded shortly after 7 p.m. to the intersection of King and Goldsmith Streets, where they found the woman suffering from significant injuries. She was transported by ambulance to a local hospital, where she was later treated for serious injuries. There were no new details regarding the woman's medical condition as of Thursday afternoon. Her identity has not been revealed. A preliminary investigation determined the woman was in a marked crosswalk at the time of the crash, but the incident remains under investigation. Police urged motorists to avoid the area on Wednesday night as the investigation continued. Excuse me. Okay. Sorry, I'm moving through the obits. Okay. Let's see what I could come up with. Okay. Progress problems with school rebuild project. $422 million buys brand new construction and complications. Out of Lowell. Out with the old and in with the new, Lowell High School students will return after the winter break to a newly opened part of the rebuild and renovation project. But issues with the $422 million project remain, including a broken elevator and faulty door lock sets and hardware. Students start winter break on December 20th, and when they return on January 5th, for many of them, it will be renovated classrooms in the 1922 building. The project team provided a construction update at the Lowell High School Rebuild Renovation project to the School Building Committee at its November 20th meeting. The project was designed by the architect firm of Perkins Eastman, is being built by Suffolk Construction, and overseen by Skanska, the owner project manager who represents the city's interests. We are currently approaching our completion of Phase 3 on the east side of the Merrimack Canal in the north portion of the 1922 building, including the auditorium and North Bridge, Suffolk Construction Senior Project Manager Kyle Regis said. A visit to the site by a reporter on Monday showed a flurry of activity centered on the yellow brick building that sits between the canal and Kirk Street. Although January 5th is the hard date open, Skanska Project Manager Jim Dowd said that once the certificate of occupancy is signed off by the city for this section of the four-phased project, the project team will coordinate with Superintendent of Schools Liam Skinner and Head of Schools Michael Fiato to get teachers access to the building to set up classrooms and prepare for the first day of classes. The opening of the front portion of the 1922 building does not include the first floor Cirrus Irish Auditorium, which is still undergoing installation of audiovisual systems. There will be electronic folks in the auditorium through January and February, fine-tuning all of the specialized systems, Dowd said. It will not be able to be occupied until March 1st. In previous meetings, Dowd noted that Suffolk contractors were working weekend shifts to get the Phase 3 opening complete, at which point the project enters its fourth and final phase of renovation of the back half of the 1922 building at the 1892 building. The fourth phase construction project was approved in 2016. The now $422 million project broke ground in 2020 with the demolition of the old dentist's office at Arcand Drive. That site became the phase one construction of the new Riddick Athletic Center, which opened in 2022. Phase 1 and 2 consisted of new construction and are complete, including the five-story freshman academy and the three-story addition that connects the academy, the gym, and the new school entrance off the Father Morissette Boulevard entrance. Phase 3 and 4 are more complicated renovation projects of the now-open 1980s building and the 1922 and 1892 buildings. Despite its many successes, the project has been dogged by some outstanding issues, including faulty door hardware throughout the site and malfunctioning elevator. A year ago, school board committee member Fred Bahu, also sits on the Lowell School Committee, asked about the issue with the ASSA Abloy lock sets for the numerous doors in the project. Staff and students continue to complain about door sets not latching or not unlatching, trapping people inside rooms, or pieces breaking off. At the November 18th City Council meeting, 2 days before the school board committee meeting, Councillor Eric Geischer asked City Manager Tom Golden for an update on the time frame for corrections to multiple security concerns due to the construction project at Lowell High School, i.e. door issues and a gate not properly securing. We have people stating that the schools are easy to get into, Bahu said. There's a safety issue happening here. Previously, Dowd told the committee that the city taxpayers will not foot the bill for those replacement parts. John Leahy, the school deputy facilities director in the facilities department of Lowell Public Schools and a committee member, asked for an update on the main elevator by the Riddick Gym, which has been the scene of many instances in which riders are trapped between floors or doors that would not open. It's been an ongoing issue, and we need to figure out how this is going to work, Leahy said. The system isn't working. Two facility employees were briefly stuck in the elevator while doing a test of the car following a recent repair fix. The elevator repair company came out to fix the elevator that hadn't been working, district spokesperson Jen Meyer said by email Thursday. After the visit, high school staff reported it still wasn't working properly, so it's an ongoing situation with that elevator, which will hopefully be repaired soon. The committee unanimously voted to cancel its December 18th meeting and set the next date for January 22nd. What time is it? I can't tell. Okay, I got time to keep reading. Sorry. All right. Out of crime, Virginia man charged in a pre-January 6 pipe bomb case out of Washington, D.C. I'll take a sip of water. The FBI on Thursday arrested a man accused of placing two pipe bombs outside the headquarters of the Republican and Democratic National Parties in Washington on the eve of the U.S. Capitol attack. An abrupt breakthrough in an investigation that for years flummoxed law enforcement and spawned conspiracy theories about January 6, 2021. The arrest marks the first time investigators have publicly identified a suspect in an act that's been an enduring mystery for nearly 5 years in the shadow of the violent Capitol insurrection. The suspect was identified as Brian J. Cole Jr., 30, of Woodbridge, Virginia, but key questions remain unanswered after his arrest on explosive charges, including a possible motive and what connection, if any, the act had to the assault on the Capitol the following day by supporters of President Donald Trump. Law enforcement officials reviewed credit card purchases of pipe bomb components, cell phone tower data, and a license plate reader to zero in on Cole, according to an FBI affidavit filed in the case. The FBI and Justice Department declined to elaborate on what led them to the suspect, but characterized his arrest as the result of a reinvigorating investigation during the Trump administration and credited a fresh analysis of already collected evidence and data. Let me be clear. There was no new tip. There was no new witness. Just good, diligent police work and prosecutorial work, Attorney General Pam Bondi said at a news conference. Calls to relatives of Cole listed in the public records were not immediately returned Thursday. Hours after Cole was taken into custody, unmarked law enforcement vehicles lined the cul-de-sac where Cole's home is, while FBI agents helped shoo away onlookers. Authorities were seen entering the house and examining the trunk of a nearby car. The pipe bombs were placed on the evening of January 5, 2021, near the offices of the Democratic and Republican National Committees. Nobody was hurt before the bombs were rendered safe, but the FBI has said both devices could have been lethal. In the years since, investigators have sought the public's help in identifying a shadowy subject seen on surveillance cameras, even as they struggle to determine answers to basic questions, including the person's gender and motive, and whether the act had a clear connection to the riot at the Capitol a day later, when supporters of Trump stormed the building in a bid to halt the certification of Republicans' 2020 election loss to Democrat Joe Biden. Seeking a breakthrough, the FBI last January publicized additional information about the investigation, including an estimate that the suspect was about 5 feet 7 inches tall, as well as previously unreleased video of the suspect placing one of the bombs. The Bureau had for years struggled to pinpoint a suspect despite hundreds of tips, a review of tens of thousands of video files, and a significant number of interviews. In the absence of harder evidence, Republican lawmakers and right-wing media outlets promoted conspiracy theories about the pipe bombs. House Republicans also criticized security lapses, questioning how law enforcement failed to detect the bombs for 17 hours. One particularly vocal commentator was Dan Bongino, the current FBI deputy director, who, before being tapped for the job this year, was a popular conservative podcaster. He floated the possibility last year that the act was an inside job and the truth was being shielded behind a massive cover-up. But since joining the Bureau, he and Director Kash Patel have described the investigation as a top priority for the FBI. In a long November 13th post on X, Bongino wrote that the FBI had brought in new personnel to examine the case and dramatically increased investigative resources, along with the public reward for information to utilize crowdsourcing leads. You're not going to walk into our capital city, put down two explosive devices, and walk off into the sunset, Bongino said at a Thursday news conference. The reinvigorated investigative focus on the pipe bombs came even as Trump administration has been engaged in a much broader effort to rewrite the history of the events of January 6, including through Trump's pardons on his first day back and the police of the rioters who stormed the Capitol. Even those violently attacked police with poles and other makeshift weapons. Investigators hunt for clues. Though Patel said the FBI and the prior administration had refused and failed to sift through each piece of data in the case, agents for years had conducted a sprawling investigation. Surveillance video taken the night before the riot showed the suspect spending close to an hour moving through the surrounding blocks, pausing on a park bench, cutting through an alley, and stopping again as a dog walker passed. Agents paired their video review with a broad sweep of digital records. They gathered cell tower data showing which phones were active in the neighborhood at the time and issued subpoenas to several tech companies, including Google, for location information. Investigators also analyzed credit card transactions from hobby shops and major retailers to identify customers who had purchased components resembling those used in the two explosive devices. The FBI affidavit filed in connection with the arrest lays out a serious evidentiary clue that investigators pieced together to arrive at Cole, who lives in his mother and father who lives with his mother and other family members in a five-bedroom house on a quiet cul-de-sac in Woodbridge, Virginia, about 30 miles south of the Capitol building. Using information from his bank account and credit card, authorities discovered the purchase materials in 2019 and 2020, consistent with those used to make the pipe bombs, according to court papers. That included galvanized pipes and white kitchen-style timers, according to the affidavit. The purchases continued even after the devices were placed. Authorities also obtained records showing Cole's cell phone was near the RNC and DNC on the day the pipe bombs were placed, the affidavit said. In addition, the FBI says Cole Neeson Centra was captured driving past a license plate reader on the evening of January 5th, 2021, less than a half hour from where the person who placed the devices was first spotted on foot around 7:34 p.m. that night. Associated Press reporters Michael Balsamo, Michael Kunzelman, Michael Biseka, and Brian White, Jim Mustaine, and R.J. Rico contributed to this report. Okay. A single hostage remains in Gaza after identification of Thai workers remain. Out of Jerusalem. Remains that militants in Gaza handed to Israel as part of the first phase of the ceasefire deal were those of a Thai agricultural worker, Israeli and Thai officials said Thursday. The return of Sudhathasika Ranthakek remains leaves just one more hostage to be returned under the agreement. This gentleman was an agricultural worker who had been employed at Kibbutz Be'er, one of the largest hit communities in the October 7th, 2023 Hamas-led attack on southern Israel that triggered the Israelis' campaign in Gaza. Israeli officials said the 42-year-old was killed in the attack and his body taken by the militant group Islamic Jihad. In Gaza on Thursday, an Israeli-backed Palestinian militia said its leader, Yasser Abu Shabad, had been killed in a dispute with another family. Abu Shabad's death could be the setback for Israel, for Israel's move to set its own alternative to Hamas rule in Gaza. The militia, which called itself the Popular Forces, said in a Facebook post that Abu Shabad was shot as he tried to resolve a dispute among members of Abu Sunima family. The group underlined that he was not killed by Hamas. Popular Forces is one of several armed Palestinian groups supported by Israel that operate in the large portion of the Gaza Strip, about half the territory still under Israeli military control. The armed group tout themselves as anti-Hamas nationalist forces but have been denounced by many Palestinians, including Abu Shabad's family, as tools of the Israeli military. The handover of Sudhathasika's remains, which took place Wednesday, brings the first phase of the shaky 8-month ceasefire in Gaza a step closer to completion. Thai Foreign Ministry spokesperson Nikordanjay Balankura said Sudhathasika's family has been notified and thanked the Israeli government for assistance that led to the release of all 31 Thai hostages taken at the start of the war. Of those, 28 were returned alive and 3 dead. Thais were the largest group of foreigners to be held in captivity. The Thai Foreign Ministry has said, in addition to the hostages, 46 Thais have been killed during the war. Israeli Ron Gavili is now the last hostage whose remains have yet to be returned. Gavili was an Israeli police officer who helped people escape from the Nova Music Festival during the October 7th attack and was killed fighting at another location. Since the October 10th ceasefire, 20 living hostages and the remains of 27 others have been returned to Israel. In exchange, Israel has released the bodies of hundreds of Palestinians to Gaza. Most remain unidentified. the return of all hostages is an essential element of the first phase of the U.S. brokered ceasefire that began in October, which both Hamas and Israel have accused the other of breaking. In exchange, Israel has been releasing Palestinian prisoners. With the first phase still incomplete, plans for the further phases of the ceasefire remain up in the air, raising questions over how it will be implemented. Under the UN-backed plan, an international security force is to deploy in Gaza to keep security and ensure the disarmament of Hamas, while an international administration headed by U.S. President Donald Trump governs the territory. However, there has been no word on the makeup of the administration, and countries have been slow to commit to participating in the security force. With so far only Indonesia saying it is preparing troops for a possible deployment. Separately, Israel carried out strings of airstrikes on Thursday in several villages of southern Lebanon, targeting what the military said were weapon storehouses of the Lebanese militant Hezbollah group. There was no report of casualties from the strikes, which came after the military issued warnings to residents to evacuate areas around the targets. Israel accuses Hezbollah of continuing to hold on to its weapons and rebuilding its arsenal in violation of a year-old ceasefire under which Israel agreed to withdraw from South Lebanon and Lebanon agreed to quell Hezbollah activity in the south. While the Lebanese government has been working to disarm some armed factions in the country, Hezbollah has refused to give up its weapons as long as Israel continues to occupy several hills along the border and carries out almost daily strikes. In southern Gaza, an Israeli airstrike on a tent encampment housing placed Palestinians late Wednesday killed five people from a single family, including two children, according to the Kuwaiti Specialty Hospital, where the bodies were taken. It says another 32 people were wounded. Israel said it launched an airstrike targeting a Hamas militant in retaliation for an attack earlier in the day that wounded five Israeli soldiers. The military said militants emerged from a tunnel and attacked Israeli troops in the Israeli-controlled part of southern Gaza. Relatives of the dead Palestinians wept over their loved ones being transported in white body bags through the city of Khan Yunis on Thursday. Aisha Abu Jazar, a woman living near the five family members who were killed, said she was shocked to hear unusually intense fire by Israeli overnight. They fired a missile at a tent of cloth, plastic, and wood. The children were asleep. What did the children do to deserve being torn apart in their sleep? What did they do to deserve this, she said. We were supposed to be in a ceasefire. War has compiled a grim toll. Gaza's health ministry says Israeli forces have killed 366 Palestinians since the start of the ceasefire. Troops have repeatedly shot and killed Palestinians near the so-called Yellow Line, which divides the Israeli-controlled part of Gaza from the rest of the territory, and Israel has carried out airstrikes in response to what it calls violation of the truce. The Hamas-led attack on southern Israel on October 7, 2023, the militants killed around 1,200 people and took more than 250 others hostages. Almost all of the hostages or their remains have been returned in ceasefires or other deals. Israeli campaigns since then has killed more than 70,100 Palestinians, according to Gaza's health ministry, which operates under the Hamas-run government. It is staffed by medical professionals and maintains detailed records viewed as generally reliable by the international community. Magdi and Azadin reported from Cairo. Associated Press writers Jin Thomas, Skorsanchi in Bangkok, Wafa Sharafa in Deir al-Baha, Gaza Strip, and Megan Janetsky in Jerusalem contribute to this report. And on that note, I am going to take my morning break. I will be back shortly and do Today in History and carry on from there. Thank you for listening thus far.
On this journey with my grandpa Lou and the memories of my grandpa will always be with me. It's important to notice if older family members are acting differently, experiencing problems with their memory, or having trouble with routine tasks. Talking about Alzheimer's can be really tough, but if you notice something, have a conversation with your loved one. Encourage them to see a doctor or offer to go with them. Early detection of Alzheimer's can give your family time to explore support services, make a plan for the future, and access available treatments. The Alzheimer's Association provides care, support, and research to help you take control of the situation with your family and manage the disease together. If you or your family are noticing changes, it could be Alzheimer's. Talk about seeing a doctor together. Visit alz.org/time-to-talk. A message from the Alzheimer's Association and the Ad Council.
This is the Talking Information Center, a window to independence through local volunteers reading over 300 newspapers, magazines, and books specific to your community.
Now available on your smart speaker by saying, play radio station Talking Information Center.
For comments and more information, call 781-834-4400 or visit ticnetwork.org.
Thank you for listening.
WVBF Middleboro, WRRS Middleboro, WRRSLP Pittsfield, WLLO Londonderry, WVALLP FL, WDJ. J.M. Framingham.
Coming up next on the Talking Information Center, it's the Washington Post. Please stay tuned.
Hello, this is Jean at the Talking Information Center reading the Washington Post for Friday, December 5, 2025. Video shows second strike hit before survivors could flip boat, lawmakers say. By Noah Robertson, Ellen Nakashima, Alex Horton, and Megan Vasquez. Video footage of a U.S. military strike on alleged drug smugglers in the Caribbean Sea shows two people attempting to flip their capsized vessel as they were attacked again, multiple lawmakers said Thursday, after speaking with the Navy Admiral who oversaw the controversial mission. The recording was shown during a day of closed-door meetings on Capitol Hill featuring Admiral Frank M. Bradley, the commander who oversaw the September 2 operation, which entailed four strikes in all. The attack killed 11 people, including the two people who survived the first blast that hit their boat. Democrats emerged from the meetings alarmed and vowed to press ahead with nation congressional inquiries scrutinizing the attack's legality. Some Republicans who have been staunchly loyal to the Trump administration defended the operation, in some cases citing the same claims made by the president, who said the lethal campaign was necessary because the illicit drug trade is responsible for killing Americans. Representative Jim Himes of Connecticut, the House Intelligence Committee's top Democrat, described the footage as one of the most troubling things I've seen in my time in public service. The two survivors, he said, were in clear distress after their boat was destroyed. The video we saw today showed two shipwrecked individuals who had no means to move, much less pose an immediate threat, and yet they were killed by the United States military, Himes said in a joint statement with Representative Adam Smith of Washington, the House Armed Services Committee's top Democrat. Regardless of what one believes about the legal underpinnings of these operations, and we have been clear we believe they are highly questionable, this was wrong. Senator Tom Cotton, Republican of Arkansas, chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, disputed the Democrats' account. He called the repeated strikes righteous and said he would have given the same orders if he had been in Bradley's position. The first strike, the second strike, and the third and the fourth strike on September 2nd were entirely lawful and needful, and they were exactly what we would expect our military commanders to do, Cotton said. Representative Rick Crawford, Republican of Arkansas, who chairs the House Intelligence Committee, also said there was no doubt in my mind about the highly professional manner in which the attack occurred. The September operation marked the start of the Trump administration's deadly military campaign against boats and semi-submersible vessels suspected to be ferrying drugs off the shores of Latin America. To date, more than 20 vessels have been targeted by U.S. forces, and more than 80 people have been killed, according to disclosures made public by the administration. The Defense Department announced its latest strike Thursday, saying four people were killed in the eastern Pacific Ocean. As with all of the others, the disclosure included no evidence verifying that those on board the vessel were drug smugglers or that their cargo included illegal drugs. Democrats and experts on the law of war have called the killings illegal, arguing that criminal drug smugglers can't be treated the same as enemy combatants waging war against the United States, and the footage shown to lawmakers for the first time Thursday is considered a crucial piece of evidence in determining whether the September 2 strike amounted to a war crime. Senator Jack Reed of Rhode Island, the top Democrat on the Senate Armed Services Committee, called on the Pentagon to publicly release the full video and said he was deeply disturbed by what he witnessed. In a statement, he urged Republican colleagues to press on with the inquiry and said the meetings with Bradley must be only the beginning of our investigation into this incident. Reed and his Republican counterpart, the committee chair, Senator Roger Wicker of Mississippi, were among the first lawmakers to publicly express their concerns about the September 2 operation. Wicker declined to comment after exiting Thursday's briefing. Wicker and Reed jointly announced their inquiry after the Washington Post reported last week that Bradley ordered a subsequent attack on the vessel after survivors were identified to comply with Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth's spoken directive issued before the operation's initial strike to kill everybody on board. Bradley participated in at least five closed-door meetings over about 8 hours Thursday. Two people familiar with his discussions throughout the day said the admiral confirmed that Hegseth had given a verbal order ahead of the operation to kill the passengers and destroy the boat. These people spoke on the condition of anonymity because all of the sessions Thursday were classified. They were not authorized to identify the lawmakers to whom Bradley made this assertion. Himes, the House Intelligence Committee's top Democrat, told reporters after his meeting with Bradley that the admiral had conveyed to him and Crawford, the committee chair, that there was no order from Hegseth to kill them all. Cotton said the same after he emerged from his meeting with Bradley. Spokespeople for U.S. Special Operations Command, where Bradley is the top commander, declined to comment. Hegseth has sought to distance himself from the controversy, pointing instead to Bradley, while also defending the second strike that killed the two survivors. The Pentagon has denied the Post's requests to interview Hegseth and review video footage of the strikes. Bradley considered the survivors to be viable targets, not shipwrecked, defenseless mariners, according to Cotton and another person familiar with the briefing. The two survivors could have radioed for help from associates in the area and continued their mission of shipping drugs to American shores, Cotton said. It is not clear whether they attempted to do so or if they had equipment that wasn't destroyed. Calling for help could indicate the men were still able to move drugs, but it doesn't make them combatants who pose a threat and can be killed, said Todd Huntley, a former military lawyer who advised Special Operations Forces on the law of war for 7 years. One lawmaker familiar with Thursday's briefings and the video that was shown said, "There was no boat. There was wreckage. There was no radio. There were two guys clinging to a tiny, non-awash portion of the keel of a capsized boat." Military leaders told lawmakers that they assessed the survivors might look for a radio, the lawmaker said, speaking on the condition of anonymity because of the matter's sensitivity. "But it's hard to see how they could after the first strike," the person said. "The boat was consumed by a massive conflagration, then it capsized," the person said. Some uniformed personnel who watched the second strike as it happened or saw the briefing slides afterward were disturbed by what they witnessed, said one former U.S. official familiar with the matter. "Basically, it was, why are we killing people who are stranded and pose no threat?" the former official said. Much of the scrutiny and expert analysis have focused on Bradley's assessment that the survivors left after the first strike remained legitimate targets. U.S. and international law requires protection for combatants and others who cannot defend themselves and forbids further attacks. That includes persons who have been rendered unconscious or otherwise incapacitated by wounds, sickness, or shipwreck, according to the Pentagon's Law of War Manual. It is hard to see any argument that the follow-up strike was lawful, Huntley said, unless one accepts a series of premises, that the U.S. is in a war with drug traffickers, which a broad array of legal analysts dispute, that the two survivors on board were on board a seaworthy vessel and not at risk of drowning, that the drugs and the boat itself were military objects. You have to fulfill several variables, he said. It's a pretty strained argument. The strikes have cast rare public scrutiny on decisions within the most secret corners of the military and the admiral tasked with leading the Pentagon's most elite forces. Bradley is a career special operator, and he has cultivated a strong reputation as a thoughtful and serious leader who looked out for his troops, said James Hatch, who served with Bradley at Naval Special Warfare Development Group, the unit commonly known as SEAL Team 6. The admiral's meetings with lawmakers came at a time when Republican-led committees are escalating their oversight of Hegseth and the U.S. military's targeting of suspected drug traffickers. Hegseth and members of the Trump administration have shifted their explanations for what happened during the operation since the second strike was revealed. In recent days, the defense secretary has said that he left the room where live footage of the operation was being streamed after the first strike, and that he heard about the second strike hours later. Hegseth said at a White House cabinet meeting Tuesday that Bradley made the correct decision to ultimately sink the boat and eliminate the threat. Bradley's meetings on Capitol Hill could be the first step toward a more formal investigation, lawmakers and congressional aides said. General Dan Kane, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, also attended the briefings. While some Republicans have continued to defend Hegseth's leadership, several members of Congress and aides have said Republican support for the secretary and other top Pentagon officials has atrophied. CDC vaccine panel delays vote to stop recommending hepatitis B shot at birth. By Lena H. Sun and Paige Winfield Cunningham. Atlanta. Federal vaccine advisors selected by Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. delayed until Friday a vote to lift a long-standing recommendation for all newborns to get the hepatitis B vaccine in what would be the most sweeping revision to the childhood vaccine schedule under Kennedy. The advisors heard presentations in the morning, including from two prominent vaccine critics recently hired by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, casting doubt on the safety and necessity of a three-dose series of hepatitis B vaccines given to babies, despite widespread agreement by medical and public health experts that the vaccine is safe and effective. The 11-member panel was scheduled to vote mid-afternoon on recommending the vaccine at birth only for infants born to mothers with infections. It would recommend other parents delay the first dose for babies for at least 2 months and consult with their doctors about if or when to administer it. But some members were frustrated at last-minute changes to the language, and the panel agreed 7-3 to delay a vote so they could have more time to review it. We really need to know what we're voting on, said panel member Joseph Hibbon, a psychiatrist. While babies born to uninfected mothers are unlikely to contract hepatitis,
you're listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. You are listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. Lab Radio would like to thank you, Mass Lowell's WUML, for providing the radio signal that allows us to broadcast 5 days a week. This is Elizabeth. I'll continue the reading from the Eagle Tribune, dated Friday, December 5th. Venezuelan designer busy crafting puppets in Andover. This is by Terry Date Andover. The puppet maker pulls out a small cloth ball from a bag of them. Actually, it is a head awaiting eyes, ears, and a mouth and hair, a body and a story too. Renata Berthold Bustad turns what looks like a small peeled potato in her hand and then raises it to eye level. "I know this one can be a witch," announced the puppet maker. So goes the first step in making a puppet, imagining it to be into being, seeing the featureless shape of role. Her puppets include musical composers, sorcerers, storybook characters, and historic persons. Next, in her puppet-filled apartment, she walks to a table and retrieves oversized Venezuelan fashion magazines from years ago. Her training and experience in fashion are the source of her puppet designing skills, she said. Fashion and puppets have long had a hold on her. Her life's travels have been wide, but the age of 14, she had lived on three continents. She was born in 1943 during World War II and moved with her family to Venezuela in 1949. This is not the first time living in Andover. Renata's parents sent her here at age 13 to live with an uncle in 1956 to familiarize her with English. She attended Andover Junior High for a year and then moved to Venezuela when her father, a scientist, worked in developing antidotes to venomous snake bites. As a young adult, she went back to Germany to study fashion design and then returned to Venezuela, where she introduced European fashion and manufactured clothing. In 2012, Venezuela's president, Hugo Chavez, widely described as a dictator, took her company and those of her business people, nationalizing private businesses. "He was the one who killed the textile industry," Berthold de Bustad said. "Killed my factory." She found herself needing a way to make a living. Her mother and father had introduced her to puppets when she was a child. Her father made puppets from a clay-like substance, and her mother sewed their costumes. So Berthold de Bustad turned to puppetry to survive making and selling small puppets. Venezuelans, at least many of them, were unfamiliar with puppets. "They didn't know what to do with a puppet," Berthold de Bustad said. "So I decided that they would have to learn what to do with it." She created a large mobile puppet theater that included Venezuelan characters. She wrote the stories and performed puppet shows at parties and malls. She married an American veteran in Venezuela, making her two children United States citizens. In 2014, a year after her husband's death, she fended off two attackers in a violent home invasion in Caracas. Berthold de Bustad's kids, who live in the United States, urged her to come to the country for her safety. She moved to Binghamton, New York, and then relocated to Andover in 2021. She makes puppets for fun and to sell online. She sells a lot of holiday-themed puppets. Just this morning, she shipped off one of her favorites, a green witch. It went to Ohio, she thinks, or maybe it was Oregon. Also, here are some of the large puppets she's made for the theater presentations. One is Casper, a jester. She takes his name from the puppet company Titus Cape Casper. Titus is Spanish, means puppets or puppet show. Casper is a character in German culture who goes back centuries, Berthold de Bustad said. He figures in German puppet theater, as do similar characters in other European countries, including Punch and Judy in England and Pestruka in Russia. The stories typically pit Casper against a dangerous adversary. Children love the Casper show. "Here's my friend, and he's been all over this Casper," Berthold Bustad said. He's the presenter of the shows. The particular Casper is the third one she has made. Kids have worn out the other Caspers with affection. Each Casper story brings howls of laughter from kids. They typically have a role in the show. The tales always end well, with Casper surviving the ordeals. For instance, Berthold DeBustad said, there is a story of a Casper and the crocodile. Casper tells the children he has heard there was a crocodile in the area. You have to help me, kids. You have to help find him. When you see him, you call me. Casper goes away and the crocodiles appear. The kids start screaming, hey, there he is, there he is. And when Casper comes out, the animal has disappeared. Casper cries out, where is he? Where is he gone? The scenario repeats itself three times, and each time the kids scream a little louder for Casper to come out, to come get the crocodile. Finally, Casper gets a big stick and hides. When the crocodile reappears, the children again scream. This time, Casper takes hold of the villainous reptile, and under the threat of being thrashed with a big stick, the crocodile promises he never come again and scare anybody. Puppets are important, Bustel DeBustad said. They entertain, they instruct, and they provide a creative avenue for puppet makers and puppet performers. They have been a vehicle for Berthold DeBustad, if not to reinvent, then to redirect herself. To the puppets, she brings fashion and design skills and whimsy, and the puppet brings stories and action and delight to their audiences. Haverhill Festival of Trees Garden Club sets up art piece by Jonah Frangiosa Haverhill. This year's Festival of Trees has a handmade donation among its collection of conifers, courtesy of the Haverhill Garden Club. Artist Lisa Coe designed and built a 7-foot-tall tree, which was called Enchanted Woodland Garden. It's her contribution to the Festival of Buttonwoods Museum, which is a holiday tradition and a nonprofit event that decorates and displays Christmas trees to raise money for the museum. Co, alongside her woodworking husband, Adrian Scholes, crafted the wooden sculpture by reusing fallen tree limbs found around Bradford. You're listening to Lowell Association for the Blind's Lab Radio. Lab Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. Lab Radio would like to thank UMass Lowell's WUML for providing the radio signal that allows us to broadcast 5 days a week. We're going to take a quick break to resolve some technology issues, and we'll be back to continue reading.
Cecilia Milbourne returned from a walk on the beach with her dog, Gucci. To reach her parked Tesla, she had to cross a road that city officials have known for years poses a danger to people on foot. 8 years ago, as part of a national initiative to stem traffic deaths called Vision Zero, the city shrank the number of lanes on the road, Vista Del Mar, and several connecting streets in the shoreside community just south of Venice. But they restored it to 4 lanes after an uproar by drivers, among them Octavio Girbau, who railed against a city official in a 2017 Facebook post, stating he was stuck on one of those intersecting roads in the traffic hell you created. On March 16, Girbau was driving south on Vista Del Mar as Milbourne was about to cross in a spot with no crosswalk and no sidewalk, just a concrete curb separating her from the moving cars. Girbau bumped a...
Okay, we're back. I'm sorry, I'm taking over for a moment. The trees feature natural heart-shaped slices or a cross-section of trunk or branch of cherry, maple, and birch trees that are sanded, oiled, and lacquered. Each slice holds a clay pot filled with greens, red berries, and fairies. The display also includes figurines of birds, woodland animals, and a llama. Red-handled garden tools donated by Haverhill Garden Club member Priscilla Coco add to the theme. Other club members Erica Ferguson, Tina Gotham, Amy Borden, Cecilia Whalen, and Kathleen Fitz helped Coe with the decorations. Anna Richards, the new executive director of Button Woods Museum, accepted the donation. We are delighted to welcome this remarkable piece into our collection and to share it with our community for many years to come, Richards said. The tree was first unveiled beside Santa's chair in the Button Woods Museum lobby. The Festival of Trees began on November 28th and continues through Sunday, December 14th. Hold on for 1 second.
What was the, what number did you press?
3. Okay. The festival serves as a fundraiser for the museum around the holidays, and admission is $7 for adults, $5 for seniors, and $3 for children ages 6 to 17. It's a collection of trees, wreaths, centerpieces, and silent auction items, all to get Haverhill families into the holiday spirit. The complete schedule for the event is available at buttonwoodsfot.org. All right, over to the next article. Why can't I turn the page? Okay. I'm so sorry. We're a little discombobulated today. Okay, so Orchestra Winter Wonderland Concerts brings the Nutcracker to life out of North Andover. As the Merrimack Valley Philharmonic Orchestra settles into its new home, it's gearing up for its most anticipated concert of the year. The orchestra's Winter Wonderland Concert, to kick off the holiday season, is set for 2:30 p.m. Saturday at the Rogers Center at Merrimack College, 315 Turnpike Street. The concert will feature performances by the Merrimack College Choral Group, Voices of Hope, Ipswich River Community Chorus, and two Timberland Regional High School students. Commonwealth Ballet dancers will also join the orchestra on stage, dancing to selections from the Nutcracker. Musicians will also perform in the lobby, and holiday cheer will be spread with cookies and hot cocoa and raffle baskets. The family-friendly concert is always a favorite for both the musicians and the audience, and one of the orchestra is excited to add a few new elements this year, MVPO President Jennifer Onello said. This concert brings out a lot of families and gets people in the mood for the holiday early in the season, Onello said. It's a happy, festive concert, and we're thankful to be back for it. I hope people leave this concert saying they want to make this a family tradition year after year. The MVPO is no stranger to playing pieces from the Nutcracker, but wanted to make a multidimensional aspect to create an experience of some of Pyotr Ilyich Tchaikovsky, I can't say his name, Tchaikovsky's beloved numbers like the Dance of the Sugar Plum Fairy, the Russian Dance, and the Arabian Dance, among others. Incorporating dancers as a different component to the annual holiday concert and a first for the orchestra. Anello said the stage had to be specifically outfitted to add a Marley dance floor in front of the stage for the featured performers from the ballet. While Commonwealth Ballet was able to have a few of its key performers join the orchestra for the special occasion, as it has its own running of the Nutcracker during this season. The opportunity to have a few dancers for the holiday concert is not lost on Anello, who said many ballet companies are so busy this time of year with their own performances. The holiday concert also serves as a way to feature young performers. Timberland students Cameron Stack will narrate 'Twas the Night Before Christmas, while vocalist Luke Swaney will perform Mary Did You Know. The Merrimack College Choral Group will join forces with Andover-based Voices of Hope and the Ipswich River Community Chorus for Believe from the Polar Express, and other holiday favorites, including leading the crowd in a sing-along. There will be something for everyone, with more seasonal selections like Festive Sounds of Hanukkah and the Gingerbread Waltz. The orchestra has begun its final rehearsals, seeing the show come together with dancers and choir and the exciting buzz it's creating on campus, Anello said. As the orchestra moved to its new space at the Rogers Center, it is reinventing itself and adding new musicians for its 65th season, including the holiday concert. The newcomers, the MVPO, join familiar faces because of the centralized home base in North Andover. Those musicians will be providing holiday spirit to the audience and giving people a chance to see an orchestra in their own backyard. in the Merrimack Valley, Onello said. There may be a surprise for the children in the audience as Santa could make a special appearance. We're hoping that the guy in red suit shows up, Onello said. He's got a busy schedule, so you never know, but he might just be there. For ticket purchases, go to mvpomusic.com. Okay, holiday calendar, Saturday, last days for Methuen Festival of Trees. The annual Methuen Festival, wait, did I read this? No, okay. The annual Festival of Trees, which helps raise money for historic preservation and attracts thousands of guests each year, will run through Saturday. Parking is free and located at 13 Branch Street, but reservations are highly recommended. What began as a showcase of 17 decorated trees has grown over the years to up to 240 trees and wreaths. Festivities will include raffles, auctions, entertainment, inclusive events for seniors and educators, a scavenger hunt, and a visit from Santa. General admission is $12 per day and a free for kids 10 or younger, while tickets for the first night are $60. Since its inception, the event has raised more than $2 million to preserve historic sites in the Merrimack Valley, according to the nonprofit's website. For more information or to make a reservation, visit methuenfestivalofTrees.com. Out of Groveland, the Pentucket Arts Foundation 16th Annual Makers Market comes to Veazey Memorial Park this weekend, a perfect way to kick off the holiday gift-giving season. The event features nearly 40 vendors, small business owners, artists, artisans at a charming decorated holiday spot. First hosted by the nonprofit foundation 6 years ago, the all-local handmade holiday arts, crafts, and vintage clothing fair has grown into a beloved annual community event. It features festive music to shop by and Makers Market Cafe to restore body and soul, offering scrumptious homemade food such as fresh fish chowder, macaroni and cheese, chili, and plenty of sweet holiday treats. New this year, Wreath and Greenery by the Groveland Garden Club. Shop local and support the arts this holiday season. Makers Market will be held from 9:30 a.m. to 3 p.m. Saturday in Veazey Memorial Park, 201 Washington Street. Admission is free. North Andover, the North Andover Parish Unitarian Universalist Church of North Andover, announced the return of a popular holiday tradition with the 67th annual Red Bow Fair to take place from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. Saturday at the church, 190 Academy Road. The fair is free and open to the public. The fair's silent auction will be available for viewing and bidding online through 1:30 p.m. Saturday. The silent auction will feature items such as tickets to sport events, original art, jewelry, restaurant certificates, and more. The Red Bow Fair will also raffle off a quilt as well as instant wine cellar prizes. The quilt and wine raffles are available by visiting bit.ly/Red Bow Fair. All proceeds benefit the North Parish Church and its missions. Out of Andover, the Andover Holiday Market returns this year from noon to 6 p.m. Saturday at South Church, 41 Central Street. The market is the primary fundraiser for the Andover Farm Markets. Proceeds benefit both the Andover Farm Market and the Village Food Hub. The market will feature indoor and outdoor activities, including juried artisan market with local artisans and food producers, live music, children's activities, a beer and wine garden, fresh food, and opportunities to take holiday photos. The outdoor food court will feature seafood, barbecue, vegan chili, sweet treats, Sicilian specialties, and a hot cocoa bar. Buy raffle tickets to support food justice efforts and a chance to win items donated by vendors and the community. All proceeds from the raffles will be donated to the Village Food Hub and earmarked to support the Andover Farmers Market SNAP match program. SNAP match is also available at the holiday market. Sydney's Rainbows and Village Play Space will be on site with children's activities. Visit with Santa and Mrs. Claus will make special appearances between noon to 3 and then 4:30 to 5. Olaf from Frozen will be at the market from 3 to 4:30 p.m. There is a suggested $2 donation per person and or a $10 donation per family to benefit the Andover Farmers Market. For more information, visit andoverfarmersmarket.com or Andover Farmers Market Instagram and Facebook pages. Christmas Stroll and Elf Hunt Friday out of Haverhill. The Christmas Stroll will return downtown in festive spirits with scavenger hunts, a holiday art market, entertainment, and the tree lighting on Friday at Washington Square of Merrimack Street. That's today. The stroll is from 4:30 to 8:30 p.m. with the tree lighting slated for 6:30 p.m. Children can participate in the Find the Elf Hunt throughout downtown businesses, while adults try a taste of signature holiday cocktails at participating restaurants. Event maps will be available on site. The holiday art market will be hosted at the Garibaldi Club, 80 Washington Street, and offer an opportunity to get started on holiday shopping while supporting local artisans. Breakfast with Santa in Haverhill. Haverhill Lions Club presents Breakfast with Santa from 8:30 to 11:30 on Saturday at Maria's Family Restaurant, 81 Essex Street. Admission is $5 per person, which includes entry, breakfast, and an opportunity to take a picture with Santa. Tickets will be sold at the door, and the Haverhill Lions Club will accept Visa, MasterCard, American Express, and Discover cards. All proceeds will benefit Haverhill Lions Club charities. Guests are also asked to bring gently used kids and adults winter coats and jackets for the Coats for Kids drive. No vest or fleece. Please call 978-374-2268 if you have further questions. Okay, next. What do we have? What do we have? I don't want to read obituaries, so I'm going to keep going. Okay, New Hampshire in a minute. Holiday craft fair season fun sets for this weekend. Support local artists this weekend at this year's annual Winter Art Show Sale, sponsored by the Greater Salem Artists Association. The art will be available for view and for purchase during select times Thursday through Saturday at the Kelly Library, 234 Main Street. There will be original works of fine art by local artists and a fine art raffle to enter. The exhibit will be from 9 a.m. to 8:30 p.m. on Friday and from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. on Saturday. On Friday, an artist reception will be held from 7 to 8:30 p.m. For more information, visit gsaa-nh.com. Christmas at the Crossing Craft Fair out of Wyndham. Crossing Life Church is hosting its Christmas at the Crossing event from 5 to 9 p.m. on Friday and Saturday at the church, 122 North Lowell Road. The event will feature a wagon ride, fireworks, live music, vendors, pictures with Santa, bonfires, hot chocolate, kids' crafts, concessions, and a coat drive for all those in need. Atkinson Garden Club hosts Greens and Gifts Sale. Get ready to deck your halls with boughs of holly and much more. The Atkinson's Group Garden Club invites all to its beloved Green and Gifts Sale from 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. on Friday and Saturday at the Atkinson Community Center, 4 Main Street. Whether you're looking for traditional elegance or something uniquely festive, there's something for everyone. This annual event offers an abundant array of fresh greens and handcrafted decorations, perfect for adding a touch of magic to your home, not to mention how beautiful it smells. Shoppers will find a variety of wreaths, holly trees, kissing balls, centerpieces, homemade bows, ropes, and swags. All proceeds help fund student scholarships and community beautification and education projects. Out of Derry, the First Parish Congregational Church is hosting a holiday concert at 3 p.m. on Saturday at the church, 47 East Derry Road. The holiday concert, appropriate for all ages, will feature the Granite Statesman Barbershop Chorus. Ticket costs $20 for adults and $5 for children and can be purchased online at the church's website. All proceeds support the ongoing preservation of the 1769 First Parish Meeting House. Out of Salem, the Lancaster Elementary PA will host a holiday fun fair from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. on Saturday at 54 Millville Street. used toy sale at St. Thomas Church out of Derry. St. Thomas Church's annual used toy sale will be happening from 9 a.m. to 12 p.m. on Saturday at the church, 26 Crystal Avenue. The sale is cash only and bags will not be provided. So if you're going to go shopping, you need to bring your own bag. All right, on the opinion page, how much does it cost to stop being poor in America? Last month, a Wall Street portfolio manager named Michael Green created a bit of a stir with a Substack article headlined, "How a Broken Benchmark Quietly Broke America." His provocative economic argument, in a nutshell, amounts to the obliteration of an often cited but too rarely dissected metric, the federal poverty line. Green writes, "While trying to understand why the American middle class feels poorer each year, despite healthy GDP, gross domestic product growth, and low unemployment, I came across a sentence buried in a research paper. The U.S. poverty line is calculated as three times the cost of a minimum food diet in 1963, adjusted for inflation. I felt sick. It's sickening because the annual income that places an American family of four at the poverty line in 2025 using the 1963 domestic budget math is $32,150. By Green's conservative calculations, that figure should be about $140,000. The critical responses to Green's argument, as collected by the Washington Post, are uninspiring. The American Enterprise Institute, a conservative think tank, called it laughable. The Post's Julie Zazumer Weil reported, while George Mason University economist Alex Tabarrok said, "To think that we today are living in some hellish landscape compared to our parents and even our grandparents is just a complete distortion of reality." Tabarrok misses the point. As just about any working-class American family will tell you, the real deterioration of reality is the idea that a family of four can do anything but suffer on $32,150 a year. Green's math isn't novel. The Post story, for example, references the Massachusetts Institute of Technology's living wage calculator, which estimates the living wage for New Hampshire families of four with two working adults at $31.19 an hour. That adds up to an annual income, household income of $129,768. Also, back in October, a New Hampshire Fiscal Policy Institute analysis found that a family of four making the 2024 state median household income of $99,782 falls about $2,000 short of covering the collective cost of the mortgage on a median-priced home, child care for two under five, food, health care, and gas. Notice, too, the line items that aren't included, like utilities, heating costs, cell phones, broadband service, for example. For those inclined to blame the poor for their poverty, let me try to anticipate some potential criticisms. Everyone has to live within their means, so maybe don't buy a median-priced house if you can't afford it. Fair enough, so let's look at New Hampshire's rental market. To afford a market-rate two-bedroom apartment in this state, which boasts the 12th most expensive rent in the country, you have to earn about $35 an hour for an annual income of $72,971, according to the National Low Income Housing Coalition. And if you're going to do some itemized nitpicking, let me stop one of your 20th century rants before it begins. Smartphones and broadband access are not luxury items in the 21st century America. They are requirements for everyone who wishes to participate in society and the economy. The cost of participation ticket, as Green called it. And there's the big criticism articulated by Tabarrok in the Post Saturday. Green takes the poverty measure and then turns it around and turns it into middle class measure. That's the heart of it, isn't it? What does it mean to be poor, and what does it mean to be middle class in this nation of profound economic inequality? Green's piece carefully outlines the cost not of a life free of struggle, but a decent life for an American family in 2025, in which the cost of housing, childcare, health care, and where I invite you to calculate your own cost of living are at the very least within reach. Does within reach add up to something close to the poverty line of $32,150, the New Hampshire median income of $99,782, Green's conservative estimate of $140,000. One of those numbers is truly absurd, and it's not Green's. Back in the spring, I tried to get at this idea in a personal way, not to complain about my lot, but to articulate genuine befuddlement over how difficult it is to get by for a young family. I explained that my wife and I worked hard, had lived within our means, and it still wasn't enough to make the numbers work. And in that moment, when it felt like everything was crumbling, we were right at the median household income for a family of four. We were not even close to poor by state or federal standards, but we were honestly one unexpected bill away from losing the battle to stay afloat. If you can relate to our middle-class challenges, if you can easily picture that kind of struggle, what kind of life, then, do you imagine for a family of four at the poverty line in 2025? For starters, they don't live in a two-bedroom apartment because that wouldn't cost more than two-thirds of their annual income, maybe squeezed into a studio. Sorry, but that's still about 45% of income. Too high a ratio with other expenses like health care and transportation. Can a family afford the poverty level, afford child care for two children under the age of five at a cost of $29,000 a month, a year, I guess? Of course not. What happens to the household income when one parent stays home to care for the children out of necessity? Life crumbles a little more. In New Hampshire and nationally, lawmakers told a lot about the poverty line while debating elements of social safety net, especially when it comes to responsible cuts. For example, Governor Kelly Ayotte, in trying to spin her newly adopted premiums for Medicaid enrollees, suggested that truly vulnerable residents wouldn't be affected. Only those making 255% of the federal poverty line would have to pay up to 5% of their household income towards the premiums. What does the ledger look like for such a family? They earn $81,983 annually, which leaves them nearly $20,000 below the state median. We also know that a family at the median, the Fiscal Policy Institute's calculation, finishes the year about $2,000 in the red just when it comes to meeting basic expenses. So things are beyond tight for our family of four, 255% of the poverty line, and Ayotte's new 5% premium leaves them about $4,100 deeper in the hole. That is why Democrats rightfully called the premium an income tax on the poor. That's the problem. With the poverty line as it currently exists, it misstates by a huge degree the cost of getting by. Even worse, it provides lawmakers with a false premise on which to implement social safety net cuts that compound poverty. I really hope you'll read Green's piece and the Post story on the reaction. I hope you'll consider, too, how and why vast inequality endangers everyone, even those who benefit most. And I hope you will think honestly about the kind of life available to a young New Hampshire family at the official threshold of poverty in America, and ask yourself this question: which of life's necessities should be, as a society, be comfortable denying to those we consider poor? And this is written by Dana Wormald, a lifelong resident of New Hampshire, has been a newspaper editor for more than 25 years. He is now the editor of the New Hampshire Bulletin. Quite poignant, to say the least. Okay, SNAP scam is particularly unsavory, is this next article. Practitioners of the newest scam aid at the vulnerable leave a particularly bad taste in the mouths of decent people of the world. Authorities in New Hampshire have reported increased efforts to use last month's SNAP crisis as a way to separate at-risk families and individuals from their money. Several SNAP recipients in the Granite State have gotten messages via email, phone calls, and text messages saying their benefits would be restricted until they verify their eligibility, state officials said. The scammers, posing as state social workers, demand sensitive information, including birth dates and social security numbers. It's a fast track to identify theft. These scams aid to take advantage of people when they may be feeling most vulnerable, and that's unacceptable, State Attorney General John M. Formella said in a statement. We would urge anyone receiving this type of suspicious communication to hang up, not respond, and to report it. That requires calm in the face of the messages, which are designed to alarm their recipients, claiming that benefits will be canceled or restricted until their eligibility is verified. That can be a terrifying moment for, say, a mother who relies on SNAP benefits to make sure the children have enough food to eat. Scammers often try and create a false sense of urgency, New Hampshire Health and Human Service Commissioner Lori Weaver said. We urge SNAP recipients to be cautious, protect their personal information, and contact us if they receive a suspicious call. Okay, let's see what else we have. Letters to the editor. Show support for EPA funding. Thank you, Eagle Tribune, for publishing the great news that the Department of Transportation has awarded $106 million in federal grant money to transit agencies in Massachusetts to upgrade public buses to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. MEVA gets $2.7 million from feds for low-emission buses on November 25th. The Environmental Protection Agency is being threatened by budget cuts at a time when our environment needs more protection, not less. Grants like this will help improve air quality, but if the EPA budget is disseminated, there will be no one to collect air quality data or protect air quality. Lee Zeldin, the head of the EPA, is planning more rollbacks and regulation enforcement that will have devastating effects on our environment. The Trump administration's budget proposal for fiscal year 2026 includes a 55% cut in funding for the EPA. The House Appropriation Committee put forward a bill that would have cut funding from the EPA by 23%. But contrast, the Senate Appropriations Committee passed a bipartisan bill with a vote of 26-2 that would have cut EPA funding by only 5%. Please contact your congressional representative or senators Ed Markey and Elizabeth Warren to defend the EPA and the EPA budget for 2026. Your voice makes a difference. Okay, let's see what I can read. Sorry, guys, bear with me. Bypass the sports. Okay, I'm going to do, excuse me, Dear Abby, I believe. Wait, isn't there, there should be a Today in History, but I can't find it. Okay. Dear Abby, wife carries on communicating with former best friend. Dear Abby, my best friend for more than 10 years, Ian, ghosted me. We used to talk about everything, wives, jobs, children. We spent hours together and helped each other sort out our problems. He knew more about me than my wife. With no explanation, he stopped responding to texts and messages and is ignoring my calls. I have come to terms with this and deleted him from my social media and social circles. It's been 2 years now. The problem is my wife. Everyone else in my family has removed him from their social circles. However, my wife maintains contact with him. As far as I knew, they were only acquaintances, yet now they comment on each other's posts and play online games together. When Ian ghosted me, my wife asked if she could stop playing online with him. I replied, "You're a big girl. I can't tell you what to do, but I hope you'll make the smart choice." Well, she didn't make the smart choice or the loyal one. Recently, one of Ian's daughters got married, and that's when I found out Ian and my wife were doing more than just gaming. They were still communicating online. My wife didn't respond when I asked her why she was still in touch with him. I'm not sure what my next step should be. I can't believe my partner would choose to remain in contact with someone who hurt me so badly. I'm also concerned about what Ian might say to my wife, because we used to talk about marital issues we had with our wives. Help. signed Unseen in Canada. I'm sorry, Uneasy in Canada. Excuse me. When you express to your wife what she was, that she was a big girl, and you didn't care if she maintained a relationship with Ian, she regarded it as permission. Did you tell her how deeply you were hurt and when Ian ghosted you? If you haven't, it's time you did. I can't predict how she will react, but if she cares about your feelings, she may stop playing games with your former friend. I can't help wonder if she knows why Ian cut ties, and so abruptly. Have you asked her? Next one. Dear Abby, a year ago I became seriously ill. I spent a long time in the hospital and 20 days in rehab, learning how to walk again. My daughter told me I should stay in a nursing home and give up on walking. When I refused, she stormed out and hasn't spoken to me since. I'm back on my feet, back at my work full-time, walking with a cane. I can't bring myself to forgive her for that because I needed her so badly. How do I resolve this? Signed, Disappointed Mom in Tennessee. Why do I have the feeling that there are facts you may have omitted from your letter? Surely this didn't happen out of the blue. Your daughter's reaction to the fact that you want to live independently is bizarre unless she was afraid she might have to care for you. It appears you raised a daughter who's lacking in character and compassion. Resolving this by walking your own path, literally, and deriving support from people who are capable of caring about you. All right, next we've got horoscopes. Okay, so let's see. Horoscopes for today. Sagittarius, November 23rd through December 21st. Your actions will not go unnoticed. Be mindful of how you express your feelings. Make what you're willing to contribute is common knowledge to avoid doubt and negative responses. Capricorn, December 22nd through January 19th. A change of scenery will unleash your imagination and encourage you to outperform any challenger. A positive lifestyle change is within reach. Today will be filled with personal milestones. Aquarius, January 20th through February 19th. Personal growth, happiness, and love are on the rise. The contributions you make to the causes you care about will pay off. Form connections and share ideas. Pisces, February 20th through March 20th. Separate your emotions from dilemmas or drama. Deception and confusion are apparent. Take measures to gather the facts and instill the truth are in your best interests. Aries, March 21st through April 19th. Be mindful of how you spend your cash, but don't deny yourself a new adventure. Monitor conditions, add stipulations as you go. Recognize and dismiss temptation. Taurus, April 20th through May 20th. Protect your investments, manage your money, and take better care of yourself. Monitoring your health, diet, and stress levels will be necessary. Emotional deception and a poor diagnosis are apparent. Gemini, May 21st through June 20th. Keep your money, paperwork, and possessions in a safe place. Don't fall prey to people trying to guilt you into making a donation you can't afford. Put your time and effort into love and personal growth. Cancer, June 21st through July 22nd. Interviewing for jobs and adapting your skills for a desired career change will pay off. Charm the crowd and you'll increase your chances of advancement. Leo, July 23rd through August 22nd. Socializing will give you a platform to practice your spiel and to raise awareness for something dear to your heart. A life-changing experience will unfold through an encounter with someone prominent. Virgo, August 23rd through September 22nd. Domestic troubles will brew if you aren't quick to respond. Reach out to an expert or someone you can rely on for support and facts, and it'll make it easier to get things back to normal. Libra, September 23rd through October 23rd. Let your actions lead the way and your charm mesmerize those you encounter. Hit the reset button and head in a direction that helps you make up for the lost time. Scorpio, October 24th through November 22nd. Step outside your comfort zone. If you trust and believe in yourself and your abilities, so will those you encounter. Versatility and flexibility will be key. Okay, on that note, we're going to wrap up for this week and today both. Thank you for listening to the Lowell Association for the Blind's LAB Radio. LAB Radio is a member of the Massachusetts Audio Information Network. There are many ways to listen to LAB Radio. Request a free specialized radio receiver, or for more information about our radio reading services, call LAB at 978-454-5704. You can listen to LAB Radio anytime by dialing 1-631-359-9069. Visit our website where you can tune into LAB Radio at lowellassociationfortheblind.org. This has been Diane and a brief bit with Elizabeth. Thank you for listening. Have a wonderful weekend. There are so many holiday geared events. If you have an opportunity to get out and do something festive, do it. It'll make your heart happy. Be kind to one another and stay safe in the cold weather. Take care and have a great weekend, everyone.
And has threatened them with criminal charges. That concludes this Friday's reading of the Washington Post. My name is Jean, and it's been my pleasure to read for you.
You were just listening to the Washington Post on the Talking Information Center. Please stay tuned for more programming, and thank you for listening.
Here's the forecast for the Boston and South Shore area on the Talking Information Center from the National Weather Service. For today, sunny, temperatures in the upper 20s. Overnight, increasing clouds, temperatures dropping to the lower 20s. And for Saturday, cloudy, chance of rain, temperatures in the lower 40s. The sun rose this morning at 6:58, setting at 4:12 this afternoon. Stay tuned for more heading your way next on the Talking Information Center.
This is the Talking Information Center, a window to independence through local volunteers reading over 300 newspapers, magazines, and books specific to your community.
Now available on your smart speaker by saying, "Play radio station, Talking Information Center."
For comments and more information, call 781-834-4400 or visit ticnetwork.org.
Thank you for listening.
WBDF Middleborough, WI.